Chapter 31. Headless Corpses. As the Duke of Monmouth was about to kneel and place his head on the block, he held out his hand to the notorious executioner Jack Ketch. "Here are 6 guineas for you. Pray do your business well. Don't serve me as you served Lord Russell." He had reason to be nervous. When Ketch had beheaded Lord William Russell for his part in the Rye House plot to kidnap Charles II, he had completely bungled the job. After several violent swipes with the axe, Russell was still twitching and his neck was unsevered. Monmouth, now being executed for his rebellion against James II, was understandably anxious to die less bloodily. He turned to his servant and handed him a purse containing more guineas. "Give him that if he does his work well." Then he felt the edge of the axe and said, sighing, "I fear it's not sharp enough." Ketch was unnerved by all this coolness. He raised the axe and threw it down, shouting, "I can't do it!" The sheriff had to threaten him with dire penalties before he could be persuaded to make another attempt. Looking pale and ill, he raised the axe above his head and brought it down. The crowd gave a groan, and Monmouth jerked with agony, but his head stayed on his shoulders. Now, thoroughly demoralised, Ketch made 3 more attempts. But there was no strength in the blows. The neck was only lacerated. Finally, he threw down the hatchet, pulled out a knife, and sawed the head off. The servant, holding the purse, pocketed it and walked away. And meanwhile, the crowd booed and threw things. It was no sinecure, being an executioner in those days. Ketch usually hanged his clients, but wasn't very good at that either, and most of the condemned men died by slow strangulation. It was preferable, however, to being butchered with a blunt axe, and even when the headman was efficient, it was tiring work. In 1746, Jack Thrift had to behead 2 Jacobite rebels, Lord Kilmarnock and Lord Balmerino. He severed Kilmarnock's head with 1 clean blow. It took him 3 swings of the axe to decapitate Balmerino. There were many officers of the law who felt that somebody ought to devise a swift and infallible method for taking a man's life. Half a century later, it became an urgent necessity. France rebelled against its rulers. The Bastille was stormed and its defenders massacred. The king fled and was recaptured. The terror began. The enemies of the new regime had to be killed by the hundred, by the thousand. How could it be done? The solution was found by a gentle, kindly man, well known for his good works, Dr. Joseph Ignace Guillotin. Dr. Guillotin was a Freemason, in fact one of the founders of Freemasonry in France. The Freemasons are a benevolent secret society devoted to the improvement of mankind, but the Church regarded them as wicked atheists. And it was for this reason, more than for anything else, that Dr. Guillotin found himself in the Constituent Assembly with an influential voice in the new revolutionary government of France. Now, this gentle humanitarian was horrified at some of the bloodshed he had seen. He loathed those barbarous and primitive instruments of execution, the wheel and the gibbet. He was sickened by the sight of a man swinging from a gallows all day while the crowd underneath drank beer and made merry. Guillotin foresaw the mass executions that were coming, and he brooded on how they might be made painless and swift. A moral lesson rather than a sadistic spectacle. Some kind of machine was needed. He consulted the public executioner, Charles-Henri Sanson, and they looked over various old prints and engravings. As early as 1555, the Italians had invented a beheading machine in which a heavy axe blade was placed between 2 upright posts so that it could be hauled up to the top with a rope and then allowed to fall down the groove onto the neck of a man kneeling underneath. These sliding axes had also been tried in Germany, in Persia, even in Scotland, but they'd never really caught on. The blade often got stuck in the groove or the rope caught. The old manual method was simpler and more reliable. And now occurred one of those supreme ironies of history. The man who solved the problem was none other than the king himself, Louis XVI. It was shortly before the flight that cost him his life and precipitated the terror. The assembly had asked Dr. Antoine Louis, the king's physician, to look into Dr. Guillotin's plan. Dr. Guillotin was asked to call on Dr. Louis at the Tuileries Palace, and he took Sanson, the executioner, with him. As the 3 men were engaged in examining the sketches of the machine, a stranger knocked and entered. It was the king, dressed in ordinary clothes. He asked Dr. Louis what he thought of the machine, and looked at the drawing. Then he shook his head. That curved blade wouldn't suit every kind of neck. The king picked up a pencil. What you need is something more like this. And he drew a straight, sloping line on the underside of the axe blade. Guillotine looked at the drawing. Yes, of course, you're right. A few weeks later, the first guillotine was tried out on three corpses. The king had been right. A curved blade failed to decapitate one of the corpses, but the sloping blade worked perfectly on the other two. 2 years later, the king was decapitated by the machine he had helped to perfect. For the next 2 years, until the terror ended with the execution of Robespierre in 1794, the guillotine thudded with horrible mechanical persistence, and thousands of heads rolled into the basket. As to the good Dr. Guillotine, he continued his humanitarian work. He was one of the earliest pioneers of smallpox vaccination, and his work on the extermination of smallpox undoubtedly saved more lives in Europe than his guillotine destroyed. But when he died in 1814, he already knew that it would not be his medical discoveries that would immortalise his name, but the triangular blade, with all its association with horror. This raises the interesting question, why is it that decapitation strikes us as so sickening and gruesome? Guillotine was right. As a method of execution, it's certainly more humane than hanging, electrocution, or the gas chamber. Hanging is only about 95% certain, a slight miscalculation in the placing of the rope, and the condemned man strangles to death. Men in the gas chamber have been known to hold their breath for minutes before breathing in the cyanide gas, and the criminologist Nigel Morland, who once stepped on a highly charged electric grid, is on record as saying that the last seconds of an electrocuted man must seem to be an agonising eternity. Only the guillotine has never failed to carry out its work with perfect swiftness and efficiency. And yet guillotine is remembered as a monster, because the idea of decapitation touches some deep chord of horror in the human psyche. It may be because the loss of the head is so final. Men can lose an arm or a leg and still survive, not the head. Or could it be, perhaps, because our earliest ancestors cut off the heads of their enemies in battle and often ate the brains? Is the twinge of horror due to some deep racial memory? Whatever the reason, there can be no doubt that crimes involving beheading always seem more cruel and brutal than other types of crime. And this is absurd. For sheer vicious cruelty, slow poison is probably the most inhuman method of killing. Then there are the murderers who get pleasure from the fear of their victims, like José Marcelino, Mexico's Lover's Lane killer, captured in 1973, who admitted, "I liked it so much to see the males squirm and the women frightened and crying that I made my threats last a long time. I enjoyed the fear of death in their eyes." By comparison, murderers like Crippen and Patrick Mahon seem decent and sane. Yet it's Crippen and Mahon whose cases are endlessly rehashed by crime journalists under the titles like Horror of the Headless Corpse. Still, no matter what the general public may feel about them, Crippen and Mahon are of scant interest to the professional criminologist. He is concerned with the motivations behind a crime, and it hardly matters to him what the killer does to dispose of the body. On the other hand, he finds a criminal like Patrick Byrne, the Birmingham YWCA killer, of altogether greater interest. There's no need to ask why Byrne killed Stephanie Baird on December the 23rd, 1959. That's perfectly obvious. He was drunk and he wanted sex. When he had strangled her into unconsciousness, he undressed her and raped her. All that straightforward, if horrible. But why did he then cut off her head and commit further sexual acts on the body? Why did he, even then, go out and try to kill another girl by hitting her with a stone? Why did he write a note saying, "This was the thing I thought would never come"? In the course of his confession, Byrne said one thing that provides a key to the strange personality. He said he wanted to terrorise all the women in the hostel to get my own back on them for causing my nervous tension through sex. This is a curious statement. Even the most stupid man must see that women are not to blame for making him sexually excited. A cat may as well blame mice for making it feel hungry. But Byrne was not trying to be logical. He was trying to explain, in his own fumbling way, what dark forces had suddenly mastered him when he found himself in a room with an unconscious girl. He also admitted to a psychiatrist that he had been indulging for years in daydreams in which he cut up girls with a circular saw. This brings us altogether closer to the heart of the problem, for what we can see so clearly in Byrne's case is that when he made his way into the YWCA that December afternoon, it was not simply a girl he wanted, ordinary sexual intercourse. It was somehow all women, all the women in the world. He was expressing one of the savage, basic frustrations of man. In 1930, Freud published a book called Civilization and Its Discontents, in which he advanced a disturbing and profoundly pessimistic theory. He suggested that man is not made for civilization, or civilization for man. Man is a carnivorous animal, and his basic instincts are violent and aggressive. Whether we like it or not, it is natural for him to go on a raiding party to another village, kill the men, and then drag off the women for his own pleasure. As natural as it's considered for a tiger to eat antelopes. But this human tiger was also intelligent and gregarious. He learned to live with other human beings in communities and to create civilization. Every step he's taken into civilization has been a violation of his basic instincts. Culture is another name for suppression of these instincts. The great basic conflict of all human existence, says Freud, is the conflict between the individual's craving for personal gratification and the claims of society. So how can man be happy? Unhappiness is a basic part of his condition. Less pessimistic psychologists, like Abraham Maslow, have pointed out that this is a one-sided view. Happiness does not mean unlimited self-indulgence. The history of crime and violence reveals to us that the men who could indulge themselves without self-discipline, Caligula, Ivan the Terrible, Vlad the Impaler, were not particularly happy men. Long-term happiness must involve self-discipline. Nowadays, there are very few reputable thinkers who take Freud's argument about civilization seriously. Nevertheless, without fully intending it, Freud had expressed the basic psychology of psychopathic killers like Patrick Byrne, Jack the Ripper, and Peter Curtin. These are men who feel that man and civilization are simply not made for one another. Consider, for example, the nature of the male sexual drive. Unlike most women, man is not basically faithful. Particularly when young and virile, the average man would be perfectly happy to sleep with a different girl every night. Even healthy men have their sexual fantasies. Surely, where sex is concerned, civilization is intended to torment males, as you might torment a caged tiger by poking it with a stick. Taking it a step further, is a man to blame if he seizes his opportunity to grab a girl and to pull her into a dark alleyway? This is what Byrne meant when he talked about getting his own back on women for causing my sexual tensions, and he was almost paraphrasing Sigmund Freud. But what about the decapitation? This is also easy to explain. Once a man is possessed by this urgency, like a fox in a chicken farm, he is subjected to endless twinges of desire, like electric shocks. He compensates for an increasing feeling of frustration and inferiority with daydreams, in which he dominates the girl completely. And the longer the fantasies continue, the more violent they're likely to become. Charles Milquist, arrested in 1958 for the sex murder and decapitation of 15-year-old Bonnie Lee Scott near Chicago, admitted to years of fantasizing about naked women and of tossing them into huge grinding machines. When such a man finally finds himself with his hands around the throat of an unconscious girl, sexual intercourse is not enough. It seems an anticlimax. His overheated desires crave some stronger satisfaction, some ultimate act of violation and possession. And here the basic human revulsion at the idea of decapitation rises up from the subconscious, the ultimate act of aggression. What is equally significant is that both Byrne and Milquist were horrified by what they had done. Byrne said he was glad the police had found him. The murder had tormented him for the past 2 months. Milquist also made his confession in a long, relieved babble and admitted that he had been unable to sleep after the murder. Not only is their act of violence no solution to the cravings that produced it, the killer recognises that he is further than ever from a solution. Many killers of this type commit suicide. The pattern can be clearly seen in the case of Jack the Ripper. The early victims, Mary Ann Nichols, Annie Chapman, Catherine Eddowes, were mutilated in the area of the genitals, indicating that the Ripper's basic obsession was with the woman's sexual function, perhaps with the womb. The last murder took place indoors. This time the killer had unlimited time at his disposal, and the victim, Mary Kelly, was not only disemboweled, but almost decapitated. Then the murder ceased, and all the evidence suggests that the Ripper committed suicide. The novelist Zola based a novel on the Ripper's crimes, La Bête Humaine, the human beast. This goes to the heart of the problem. Such a man has decided to become the solitary hunter in search of prey, rather than a responsible human being. In doing so, he has retreated from society as deliberately as if he had decided to become a Trappist monk. But men like Berne, Melquist, or the Ripper lack the qualifications for becoming hermits. They need society. Hence the conflicting whirlpool of urges that may end in suicide. The case that most clearly demonstrates the complex, morbid psychology of the human beast took place in Cleveland, Ohio, in the mid-1930s. The curious, unsolved case of the Butcher of Kingsbury Run. Between 1935 and 1938, the Mad Butcher killed at least a dozen people, hacking the bodies into small pieces and removing the heads, several of which were never found. On September the 23rd, 1935, two decapitated bodies were found in the area of Kingsbury Run and East 45th Street, a slum area. Both had been mutilated with a knife. Both were men, one a 28-year-old medical orderly, the other a 40-year-old vagrant who was never identified. The fact that both victims were male suggested that the killer was homosexual and a sadistic pervert. But when 4 months later the headless body of a 42-year-old prostitute was found not far from Kingsbury Run, the police became less sure that they were looking for a homosexual. The woman's body had been hacked as if in a frenzy, and the head was never found. At intervals during 1936, three more victims were found in the area. All were men, all were headless, and in one case the head was never found. The killer was obviously possessed by some kind of frenzy. Some of the bodies were little more than a pile of mangled pieces. On February the 23rd, 1937, the victim was again a woman, headless and in pieces. In June, the dismembered body of a 30-year-old Negro woman was found in a burlap bag under the Lorraine Carnegie Bridge. The ninth victim, a man, was found in July. He had been decapitated and the body hacked in pieces. The head was never found. And in 1938 there were victims. A dismembered and headless woman was found on April the 8th, and on August the 17th, the Mad Butcher, as the press called him, committed another double murder, a man and a woman. In each of these cases, the killer decapitated the victim, and in six of them, the heads were never found. The man who was then in charge of Cleveland's police department was Elliot Ness, hero of TV's Untouchables. Ness recognised that the usual methods of detection were of doubtful value here. But he realised that the mad killer was finding most of his victims among prostitutes and down-and-outs. The latter congregated in a shantytown area in the centre of the city, near the market. One night in August, Ness raided the place, forced its inhabitants to leave, and burnt it down. This had the desired effect of depriving the killer of his victims. There were no more murders. Ness also reasoned that the mad butcher must be of a certain type. He must be big and powerful to overpower his victims. He must own a car to transport the bodies. He must live alone and in some quiet area, perhaps an unfrequented cul-de-sac, in order not to arouse the curiosity of his neighbours. And in order to fit this pattern, he must be rich, or at least well off. Ness's team made painstaking inquiries in Cleveland society, and, according to Oscar Fraley, a chronicler of the Untouchables, soon found a suspect who fitted. He was physically huge, homosexual, sullen and paranoid, and well-to-do. Ness had the man brought in for questioning, and for months played a cat-and-mouse game with him. The man, confident that he was cleverer than the police, almost admitted the murders and dared Ness to find evidence. And finally, while Ness was still searching, he had himself committed to a mental home, where he died a year later. Ness never doubted that this was the torso killer. Ness's suspect was an intelligent, literate man. He may well have read Freud's Civilization and its Discontents. If so, he could have added a final footnote, that the man who lives as a beast of prey will almost certainly die as one, alone and unmourned by his fellow creatures.